Welcome to the QuoraCast. I'm Jeff Meyerson. Martin Ford is a computer engineer and the author of the book, The Lights in the Tunnel, Automation, Accelerating Technology, and the Economy of the Future. Martin Ford, welcome to the QuoraCast. So much of your book revolves around this metaphor of the lights in the tunnel. What do the lights represent?
The lights basically represent consumers or workers. Each light is an individual person in the economy, and the brightness of the light basically represents how much purchasing power they have to go out and actually buy things and help drive the economy. And it's sort of a mental simulation, or what it's designed to show is that over time, as you automate more jobs or as technology increases inequality and drives down wages, then you have more and more consumers who have less and less purchasing power. You have a very small number of very bright lights, you know, very wealthy people that are doing very well, but the bulk of people over time are doing worse and worse. And so they really, essentially, they have less ability to go out and purchase the products that are being produced and thereby drive economic growth. So eventually you get into kind of a, what you might call a downward spiral economically.
Is there anything that you feel this metaphor doesn't capture accurately? Like maybe after you wrote the book and were rethinking it, anything that you reconsidered?
Well, I think it was never intended to be an exact representation of reality. It's really a thought experiment that demonstrates the overall trend and the things that we need to think about. In the real economy, of course, things are a lot more complicated. You have all kinds of feedback loops. You've got nonlinear impacts. It's almost like chaos. It's very much like trying to model a climate system. There's a tremendous amount of stuff going on. So it's not quite as simple as what I represent in that thought experiment. For example, when their income begins to fall, one thing that they will do, history has shown, is they'll take on debt. And so they'll take on more debt, and they'll continue buying things. So it's not quite as smooth as the simulation shows. But overall, I think it captures the essence of the concern that we need to have for, you know, the way this is likely to unfold.
And you write that the by and large economists don't really understand this scenario, or they don't acknowledge it, maybe don't understand the implications. Is that what compelled you to write the book, that nobody else was really understanding that this kind of loop, or the fact that consumers are also workers, and there are less and less workers due to advances in automation?
Right. I mean, it's something that isn't getting a lot of attention. I'm not saying that economists don't understand it. I mean, honestly, it's a fairly obvious point, so I'm sure they do understand it on some level.
Right.
I think the issue is that economists are very much focused on data. And the reality is, if you look at the data from the past, it's not, this isn't obvious. There isn't a lot of evidence to support what I'm saying in terms of past history.
Right, and there's that easy counter-argument that you kind of take head-on in the book, that, any increase in technology is always met by the worker advancing his skills.
Right, and that's been the case historically. And as I said, there's also the issue of people finding alternate ways to consume. They will take on debt and so forth. And as a result of that, the trend that I'm suggesting, this idea that consumption falls as inequality rises, and it's not obvious in the historical data so far. And that's the reason that I think economists don't talk about it much, because they're very data-driven. Whereas my thought process and my book are really focused on the future. I'm concerned with what's going to happen down the line, 10, 20 years from now, as this whole thing kind of accelerates.
What about scientists? Do you talk to scientists much about this?
Yeah, the technical people and the engineers are, I think, generally a little bit more open to it, because they're focused on the technology itself, and the implications of the technology are relatively clear to them. So a great many of those people are more open to this idea than some of the economists are. Although, in fact, the economists even are coming around now. You hear a lot more discussion of this now than you did back in 2009 when I wrote this book. So there's definitely a progression toward...
Is that because of an increase in data, or just like kind of a paradigm shift in how the economists are thinking?
I think more and more economists are becoming aware of the technologies. I mean, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence out there. We've now got for example, Google's self-driving car. We've got IBM's Watson. You know, these are stories that have gotten really a lot of attention in the media, and I think it's drawn attention to this issue, and so we're seeing a lot more discussion of it. And of course, inequality, you know, is rocketing ahead. I mean, you know, it's just getting worse and worse. There's no evidence to suggest that inequality is going to taper off or anything. So I think the economists are getting more in tune over time.
What is it that humans can do that computers cannot right now? And how is that sort of changing?
Well, I mean, right now, if you look at the job market, what you see is that it's essentially polarized. So the really good, solid middle-class jobs, which essentially involve, you know, coming to work and doing relatively routine things and getting paid pretty well for doing that, those jobs are evaporating. They've been you know, disappearing for a long time. And what we're left with are really the really high-skilled jobs at the top that require, at a minimum, a college degree and very often maybe a graduate degree, the more cognitive-type tasks. And then at the bottom, a whole bunch of really low-skilled jobs, and those are so far protected from automation primarily because of things like dexterity and visual comprehension and the ability to...
That's like the housekeeper example, the housekeeper figuring out, you know, she needs to clean the top of the fan because she sees a little smidgen of dust.
Right. That together with natural language ability, the ability to interact with people, you know, using natural language. So far, machines haven't encroached too far into that area. But, of course, you know, we're seeing evidence that that's changing as well. So as we look forward, we're seeing machines move into both of those areas. I mean, you look at IBM Watson, and that's an example of how machines are getting more cognitive and how they're going to be able to really encroach on those higher-level type jobs. And then you look at some of the advances that are happening in robotics. So essentially what we're going to see, I think, is machines moving into both of these areas. I mean, they're going to increasingly take on the higher-level cognitive tasks, and we see examples of that already. There's an application from a company called Narrative Science that can do basic journalism. It can write
stories
for business and sports and things like that. And then there are robots that are getting much better at being able to see in three dimensions and you know, do more manipulative tasks. All of that is accelerating forward. So, you know, both of those groups of jobs that we have left in the economy now, the low level and the high level, are ultimately going to be impacted more and more. So sort of that missing, hollowed out middle is just going to gradually expand over time, and more jobs are going to be, you know, essentially threatened. So this is going to be an ongoing process.
And how long have you had these sorts of, like, feelings or suspicions? Like in college or high school, like were you starting to sense at all that this was kind of like a coming problem?
I started not that far back so much. I started thinking about it, you know, fairly recently, back in 2008, while the financial crisis was unfolding. I really began to focus on the economy and think a little bit about how technology intertwined with that. I also run a small I've run in the past a small software business, and I've seen how these technologies actually impact my own business in terms of the type of people that I had to hire and so forth. I mean, there was a time in software when, you know, the product was shipped on physical media and there was a printed manual to go along with it. And all of that involves a lot of, you know, work for people to create that content and then print it and manufacture it and then, you know, fulfill it physically and so forth. But of course, all that in the realm of software has largely disappeared. People just download software from the internet, so there isn't really a need for all of that manual type work. So I've seen how it has altered my own business, and I think that you know, going forward over the next decade or two, it's really going to accelerate quite dramatically across the board.
And speaking of the housing bubble, you actually wrote that you felt like the housing bubble masked some of the problems that automation was causing in a much more subtle sense. Like, you know, obviously the housing bubble was a very sharp and noticeable destructive impact to the economy. What is it that you feel like was sort of affecting the dangerous economic change sort of under the covers of that housing crisis?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this whole process is being ongoing. excuse me. One thing that the housing bubble did is it created a tremendous amount of construction jobs. I mean, building wood frame houses is very labor intensive. I mean, it's one of the areas left of the economy that still is very labor intensive. And so there were a lot of jobs created there. There were also peripheral jobs for loan agents and people like that. So that helped mask the problem that was developing. Also, of course, it helped on the consumer side as well, because people were accessing all this equity in their homes and going out and spending it. You know, they were buying big screen TVs and all kinds of stuff with money they took out of their homes. So both in terms of the job market and in terms of consumer spending, that acted to kind of paper over it, so it wasn't quite so visible. But clearly, it was during that time progressing. And after the crisis, it became much more evident to what we're left with. But again, I still think that the real story is going to be in the future. You know, it still lies ahead of us. You've got this ongoing acceleration, and the really dramatic impact is going to be, maybe a decade from now.
Yeah, and you have this table in your book. Where you list all these jobs and by percentage of the workforce that the job takes up. You know, you have accountants there, you have doctors there, obviously retail people, fast food people, and you talk about ways in which almost all of these jobs get automated. What is the definition of a software job that you give?
Well, what I call a software job is a job that could be automated with just software. In other words, it's a knowledge worker type job. Someone that sits in front of a computer, probably, just manipulating information. I mean, artificial intelligence and smart algorithms are getting better and better. In order to automate a job like that, all you need is software. I mean, you don't need expensive robot arms and things like that, because those people are just engaging with information. Very often, those same jobs, of course, are also susceptible to offshoring. Someone in another country, maybe earning a much lower wage, can also do those types of jobs.
So would you say that the job of one person that is using some sort of maybe like domain-specific software is oftentimes a replacement for a job that multiple people were fulfilling as knowledge workers before?
Right. I think that's probably the trend. I mean, I think what you'll see is that layers of management can disappear. I mean, where once you might have had a whole bunch of analysts doing all this knowledge work and perhaps reporting this information to a manager, in the future what we'll see is that the software tools will get so good that a lot of those analyst jobs will disappear, and the manager will essentially be able to access the tool and do the job by himself or herself, because the software is so smart. So you'll see kind of layers within organizations sort of evaporate over time as the software tools get better and better and essentially begin to encapsulate what a lot of these people were once doing.
Did this book scare you when you were writing it?
Well, it certainly made me worry. I think this is a genuine concern looking forward. We can hope, the thing is, we don't know how exactly it's going to unfold. We can hope that it'll be very gradual and that we'll have time to adapt, but you don't know that. There might be, for example, some really disruptive innovations. Someone might really figure out artificial intelligence and then, become widely available quite rapidly. In that case, it could be, quite disruptive, and it could happen very rapidly. So it's reason for concern. I think it's definitely one of the major challenges for our society going forward.
Yeah, I found the book, I found The Lights in the Tunnel to be really sobering, because I read it around the time I was reading The New Digital Age, which is like this book by Eric Schmidt, Google's chairman, and that's kind of like a look into the future also, but it's like a little more positive. And then I'd also been reading The Singularity Is Near by Kurzweil, and that's also very positive. And then I read The Lights in the Tunnel, and it like totally put a damper on my whole futurist, optimistic mentality. But what is your take on other futurist authors? Like, do you see it as mutually exclusive, or is it very much just like another hypothesis that kind of ties in with what other people have to say?
Well, I think it ties in with what they're saying. I think that in general, techno-optimists, especially people like Ray Kurzweil, tend to underestimate the impact of inequality. I mean, they don't think enough about what this means for 90% of the population. And of course, a lot of these people are extraordinary people. I mean, Ray Kurzweil probably doesn't hang out with, you know, average, typical people very often. He's living in kind of an elitist type world. And I think that's very often true of techno-optimists who have been very successful, the people who have built companies, for example, and become billionaires. I mean, they see a very rose-tinted vision of this, and they don't necessarily focus so much on how all this is going to impact, you know, broad stretches of the population. But I think that's going to be a critical issue. It's not all just going to be about this positive story of boundless growth and advancement. A lot of people are essentially going to get cut out of the loop. They're going to find that they simply don't have any marketing skills to offer in the job market. And as a result of that, they're not going to be able to go out and purchase all this wonderful stuff that is being produced by the techno-optimists. I mean, everyone needs a market, no matter how extraordinary or smart or innovative you are. Ultimately, what you're doing is you're selling something. And there has to be a market out there of people who can buy what you're selling. If, in fact, there weren't a vibrant market out there for smartphones, then, you know, the iPhone would have never happened. Apple would have never made that investment to create that technology if it didn't believe that there were lots and lots of people out there who had the ability to buy it. And I think that, you know, that's going to become more and more of an issue going forward. So it's something that we're going to have to fix. If we want to have the kind of optimistic vision that people like Kurzweil are talking about and other techno-optimists, we're going to have to ultimately solve this problem. I don't think it will sort itself out by itself.
What do you think of Kurzweil in general? Like, what do you think of his writings? Do you agree with some of the other stuff that he has to say?
I agree with what other people have said, which is there's kind of a mixture of, you know, really good insight and stuff that he's just off the wall seems crazy. you know, I think that the singularity, you know, was ultimately, as it was first envisioned, was a time of great unpredictability. It was essentially, you know, it was compared to the event horizon of a black hole, and means that beyond that point, you really can't see the future. It's going to be something extraordinarily disruptive.
Right. It's like technology is moving faster than you can register it.
But the whole idea is that once that happens, who knows what's going to happen. It's pretty unpredictable. But Kurzweil has sort of fleshed out the details for us. He seems to understand exactly what's going to happen after this occurs. And he's jumped into this whole thing in particular about immortality and you know, living forever. And
Computonium.
Yeah, and that, to me, that doesn't necessarily follow. I mean, perhaps we're going to see the advent of true artificial intelligence, and that's going to lead to super intelligence, in other words, machines that are dramatically smarter than any of us. Beyond that, it's hard to say what happens. I mean, to me, it's not obvious that these smart machines are going to turn their efforts toward making us all immortal. Maybe they'll have other things they want to do.
Yeah, there's the gray goop hypothesis, right?
Right. I mean, there are a lot of certainly very negative possibilities as well, and I think those are things that, as we get closer to true artificial intelligence happening, I mean, these are things that we need to worry about.
And I think one way that he defines the singularity is the point at which Moore's law hits this. I guess it's sort of like a knee, like a knee in the exponential growth.
An inflection point, yeah, a point where, I mean, it just goes vertical, right? It goes, things begin to move so fast that it becomes incomprehensible. And essentially what it's about machines, smart machines designing smarter versions of themselves, I think is the way it's usually explained. But
Go ahead.
I mean, I think that could happen, or maybe not. I don't know. You know, it depends on whether really the critical issue is whether or not we're going to build true human-like artificial intelligence. If we succeed in doing that, then I think there's certainly a good argument that very soon there will be super intelligence. There will be machines much smarter than us, and that could indeed result in an intelligence explosion. If that happens, it will be disruptive on lots of levels. For instance, the issue that I've been focusing on, which is unemployment from automation. I mean, if you imagine, you know, machines that are literally smarter than people, then you really have to wonder what jobs for people would be left at all if that technology were to become affordable.
Or whether we'll even need jobs.
Right. That certainly is disruptive, but then there are also lots of negative things that could happen, you know, that we, you know, all the science fiction scenarios from the Terminator movie and the Matrix and all that, all of those would be real concerns in an issue with, you know, the world with true artificial intelligence. But what I don't see is all this focus on, you know, immortality and people living forever and all of that. I think is a little bit overdone in terms of the whole singularity.
Yeah, it's putting the cart before the horse, maybe.
Yeah.
But as far as this knee in the exponential curve, maybe it's not even worth measuring or trying to put a precise finger on it, but do you feel that this is maybe something that is on the horizon of the coming decade? Is that why you feel why in the next decade we're really going to see some of these horrifying effects that automation might have on the economy?
Well, you know, the thing I focus on is a much more mundane form of automation. I mean, I'm focused on what we would call narrow artificial intelligence or specialized artificial intelligence. In other words, machines and computers that can do relatively specialized things. And that's important because, you know, most of the jobs that we do are specialized. I mean, people don't get hired for the most part to be jacks of all trades. They get hired to be relatively, you know, specialized and do specialized things. I mean, that's sort of the whole idea of progress. You know, goes back to Adam Smith talking about the division of labor and the fact that, you know, over time we become more and more specialized. So it doesn't take true artificial intelligence of the kind that Kurzweil was talking about to automate a lot of these jobs. So, you know, that's what I'm focused on, a near-term phenomenon. And in fact, I think there's an argument that process could undercut the kind of thing that Kurzweil was talking about, because as this unfolds and as we have fewer and fewer consumers out there driving the economy, what we're going to see is that there may be a less vibrant market for innovation. And, you know, creating true machine intelligence is going to take an enormous investment. I mean, it's there has to be a market out there. And if we get into a sort of an economic, you know, flat line where we're having trouble growing, then there may be less incentive to make those investments. So it could actually push back the time when those kind of disruptive innovations occur.
Go ahead.
I'm just saying, in general, what I'm focused on is not the singularity. I'm focused on technologies that will come before the singularity, but
of course,
you know, automate a lot of routine jobs.
Right, and so in the latter part of the book, you talk about, you know, you kind of have laid out the lights in the tunnel metaphor. You've made several very convincing arguments about why this is a very real concern. And then you start to outline some potential solutions, some like ways that you could maybe preempt this crisis as well as things that, you know, may be done as soon, you know, after the crisis actually happens or when politicians start to recognize that this is a real issue. So what are some of those solutions?
Well, in the nearer term, we can do things like shift taxation from labor to capital, for example. You know, right now, a lot of our social safety net, for example, and things like Social Security and health insurance and Medicare, they're all funded by payroll taxes, which fall, you know, basically on labor. I think that one thing we can do is try to shift that to other forms of taxation that fall more heavily on capital, because what we're seeing over time is that a lot of industries are becoming more capital intensive. They're employing fewer people, and instead they're using you know, computers, technology to do the work. And so when they make that transition, essentially they're able to escape taxation.
What defines a capital-intensive company?
Basically, you know, any company that relies on technology or factories or equipment rather than people. Now, it used to be in the past that when you talked about a capital-intensive industry, you know, usually you would visualize lots of concrete and steel. It would be, you know, big, huge industrial machines and factories and so forth. But now we've got, you know, companies like Google and Facebook are in a sense capital-intensive, but it of course it's not massive infrastructure. In fact, it's you know, it's technology. It's you know, computing farms and facilities and so forth. But a lot of it is just intellectual capital. But these are companies that are becoming enormously influential. They have enormous valuations, and they have enormous revenues. But they've got really just a tiny number of people, and it's not labor intensive at all. And that, you know, information technology companies like Facebook and Google are on the leading edge of that, of course. But I think that that's a trend that we're going to see throughout the economy in the future. You know, a lot of industries are going to look more and more like, you know, like Google or like Facebook.
But aren't these companies adding value to the economy? Like, even though they're just you know, kind of snowballing more and more intellectual capital, they're doing things that are, you know, not all cases are sort of automating jobs away from people. In a lot of cases, they're developing new services that are don't really have a precedent to steal a job from.
Right. I mean, they're definitely adding value in terms of creating lots of things, lots of services that we can use. You can now use Facebook and connect with people. You can use Twitter. You can do all this stuff, and it's all pretty much free, and that's great for consumers. But the problem is it doesn't create many opportunities for people to earn income. Not really. I mean, there are definitely opportunities there, but if you look at, you know, you can do things like you can write your own ebook and put it on Amazon. You can you can use Google's AdSense and have a website or a blog and earn revenue. You can do those kinds of things, but they're all subject to this kind of long tail type distribution, and most people end up way out on that tail, and it, you know, the kind of income that they can generate is just like pocket change. So it's really a winner take all scenario. There aren't many solid opportunities to earn revenue on the web, but there are lots and lots of opportunities to do stuff for free. You can read Wikipedia for free. You know, it's a great resource. And it's true that all of that has value, but it doesn't put a roof over your head or put food on the table. And that's the problem that I think a lot of people are going to run into in the future. The extreme case of that is the homeless person who has a laptop and can tap into all this digital bounty that's out there.
I have seen that homeless person a number of times.
Yeah, they exist. I mean, you can Google homeless blogger and find a number of people who are homeless and write blogs regularly. And this is the kind of dichotomy that we face. There's all this abundance out there in terms of, you know, this stuff that's there, but it's a digital abundance. I mean, it's stuff that you can access to your computer and do all this stuff for free.
You can't download a hamburger.
Right. You cannot, and it doesn't translate into, you know, the right to have a roof over your head.
And one of the solutions that you suggest is sort of like a wealth redistribution thing, where maybe people would actually be paid to do this sort of intellectual work, like blogging or reading Wikipedia all day or doing Coursera stuff. How can you outline that sort of wealth redistribution model a little to me?
Well, the essential idea that I propose is nothing new. It's what you would call a guaranteed minimum income or a basic income. Basically, everyone would be entitled to some income, you know, automatically. What I suggested beyond that, though, is that we ought to build some incentives into it so that rather than just giving everyone the same income, we should try to create some at least basic incentives for people to do useful things. And the most important one of those would be to pursue education. You know, we want to make sure that people continue to educate themselves, and one way to do that is to pay people a little bit more if, in fact, they pursue education and succeed in educating themselves. But this idea of having some kind of a guaranteed income so that everyone, you know, at least has a floor in terms of you know, beyond which they can't fall, is not, certainly not my idea. It goes, you know, it's been around for a long time. And the interesting thing is that a lot of people read this and they say that, you know, you're a socialist. This is obviously socialism. But in fact, it's not a socialist idea at all. It actually has its origins with more free market conservative type economists in the past. For example, Friedrich Hayek, who wrote the book The Road to Serfdom, which is, you know, he's kind of an icon among libertarians and conservatives. He was very much in favor of having a guaranteed minimum income. And the idea is that you give people an income, whether they work or not, you give them some minimum, and then they can go out and they can participate in the market and help, you know, create demand and help, you know, push the market forward, as opposed to the alternative, which is that you get the government involved in essentially taking care of people, right? I mean, you could, I mean, realistically, if this really becomes a problem in the future and we have more and more people unemployed, or we have people with wages so low that they literally can't afford to live and they're on the street, I mean, the government will ultimately have to do something. And there are two paths you can take. One is to just give people money and let them go out and be part of the market. The other alternative is to have the government, you know, take care of people, build houses for them, provide services directly for them.
Have you thought about when this point might hit? Because I remember that in one section of the book, I think you say, you know, envision this scenario where 75% of the workforce is unemployed or underemployed.
Right. That, I mean, that was a thought experiment. At that point, I was talking about
75%
employment. I was saying, you know, imagine if this happened, this is what we could do. I don't know in reality we'd ever have 75% unemployment. Long before we got to that point, I mean, a lot of really bad things would happen. I mean,
right.
Our society would be under unprecedented stress. I mean, back in the Great Depression, unemployment got to about 25%, and many people feared for, you know, the continuity of society and of our system of government. So if things, you know, get that bad, a lot of, you know, really bad political things are going to be happening. So I don't know exactly how it unfolds and when that might happen, but I do believe it will, you know, become a much more serious problem going forward, for sure.
Do you think our political system is robust enough to eventually, like, acknowledge this problem and deal with it? Or do you think, like, do you think that the sorts of issues will, like, let's take the housing bubble, for example. If the housing bubble is really, you know, kind of, is something that was, I don't want to say red herring, because, like, not a purposeful distraction, but do you think there will continually be things that are brought up that are more politically correct to talk about than automation in terms of you know, what's kind of eroding the economy? Or do you think this will be?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that
because it's not very politically palatable to say, but automate. I mean, maybe it is. Like, I don't know.
It, you know, it depends on your perspective, but it's definitely getting more attention than it used to, although not much, you know, in the political sphere. I mean, you're starting to hear the press talk about it, and you're starting to hear economists talk about it sometimes. You don't very often hear politicians talking about it. You know, and it's true, it's all tied up with ideology. People on the right are not going to want to acknowledge this issue because, in general, they don't like to talk about inequality. They don't want to deal with it or acknowledge it because it doesn't fit into their worldview, which is that, you know, you've got a few people working really hard, and these are the entrepreneurs and the innovators, and these people need to be rewarded. That's the narrative on the right. On the left, you know, people are much more likely to focus on things like unions and the fact that workers no longer have bargaining power like they once did, and so forth. So it doesn't necessarily fit into either side's political narrative. But I do think that it will, you know, inevitably get more attention. And
when you talk to like right wing people, for example, and maybe you talk about the potential wealth redistribution model. do they kind of like shut down or like how has the discourse been between you and somebody that might be like particularly unwilling to discuss this?
Well, they just have a different view, and of course, and the world among conservatives, you know, the conservatives that I talk to tend to be more enlightened, and
sure,
so we have a better discussion. But if you, I'm talking about the kind of conservatives you see, the politicians you see on television, who I have not talked to, and I'm probably glad for that. the word redistribution, just the word is completely toxic.
Right.
You think about Joe the Plumber, remember, and all of that. So I don't know how to have, how it's going to unfold in terms of having that type of discussion with those individuals.
Have you thought about going into politics?
No, I'm not much of a politician. I prefer to just, kind of talk about this issue, and eventually I think as awareness increases, then I think politicians ultimately will have to begin to acknowledge it. That's for sure.
Does it inform the business decisions you make at all, like in your software company?
Well, I wouldn't quite say at that point yet. I mean, you've got to deal with reality as it is. But I do think that it's not so much me, but there are certainly, if you look in the press, there are big companies that deal more with consumer markets who are definitely concerned about this. I mean, Walmart, for example, has not been doing especially well lately. And the reason is that their customers are getting pounded by this. I mean, they their wages are stagnant. They're largely lower income or middle class people that haven't seen a raise in years. They simply don't have much to spend. And the government recently, in its wisdom, cut food stamps. Walmart is going to see flat revenues as a result of this, probably. So it's having a real effect in the economy already. So there certainly are, CEOs out there who are concerned with this issue. Whether they are ready to embrace the kind of suggestions I'm making yet is unclear. But going forward, I think it will become more and more of an issue.
And what about, a lot of this you talk about the vast income inequality, and when I think about that, I think about it in an American perspective, like the large skills gap that we have in America. But what about locations in the world where maybe there's just like a complete lack of skilled labor, or a very low amount of skilled labor. Like how does this future that you envision affect, maybe people that just are already making, very little money in India or Africa?
Well, I mean, the problem is that automation is going to unfold everywhere, and manufacturing is going to be heavily impacted throughout the world. I mean, in the United States, we really don't have many people working in manufacturing. And so the impact here is going to be somewhat muted. But if you look at countries like China and the countries that would come after China developing in the future, you see the path toward development is manufacturing.
Your iPhone is going to be built by a robot in not too long.
Right. Eventually, this will have an enormous impact. And what it will mean is going to essentially remove that path for these companies, for these countries to progress. I mean, they're probably planning on having factories to employ all those people, and yet, those factories are going to automate, and very often they're also going to come back to developed countries because once the labor sort of gets out of the equation, in many cases it will make sense to move the factories back to, so they're closer to markets, so that you minimize transportation costs and you have the ability to get products to market much faster and so forth. So there, to some extent, all of this will create a reversal of globalization. The countries that are now developing in the future will not have the opportunity to offer up cheap labor, as the path to development. That will create, lots of issues throughout the whole world. I mean, it's going to be a bigger issue in other countries than it is in the United States when we're specifically talking about the impact of manufacturing automation.
How is offshoring a precursor to automation in many industries?
Well, what you see is that you know, before you can build an algorithm or a machine to completely do a job, one thing you can do is you can electronically move that job offshore and have people do it. And historically what we've seen is that companies will do that first, and then very often as technology gets better, they will bring it back and automate it. And you see that, for example, with some customer service functions. It used to be that they would offshore it to India or the Philippines and have, you know, customer service reps deal with that. And now there are, in many cases, digital technologies, phone systems that can actually automate that. And we're going to see that more and more in the future. So I think one of the things that is likely to happen is that the offshoring companies that, you know, made a good business doing that kind of thing will have to sort of move up market. They'll have to, you know, as the lower level type tasks become more automated, if they want to continue to stay in business, they will have to look to higher level type things. And so we may see more offshoring of higher skilled jobs in the future.
And the value in the human in the this process, like the reason that the many of these jobs, I guess, cannot become highly abstracted software jobs yet, is that largely due to a human's ability to pattern match?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there are certainly some things that are still beyond machines, and our abilities to deal with pattern matching and natural language and so forth are, you know, still, you know, dramatically beyond what machines can do. Although, you know, technologies like machine learning and deep learning using neural networks and so forth are definitely making progress. Still, there's clearly a gap there. But when you take a lot of these jobs and you break them down into specific tasks and begin to automate, you know, specific tasks, a lot of it, I think, ultimately will be, you know, quite susceptible though. So we're seeing dramatic progress.
What are you working on now? Are you traveling around? Like, do you discuss this book a lot, or are you thinking about writing a new book?
Yeah, I do some speaking, and I'm also working on a new book. I'm going to have a new book out next year, hopefully in the spring. And this will be, The Lights in the Tunnel was essentially a self-published book that I put on Amazon myself back in 2009. The new book is going to be a traditionally published book from the publisher is going to be Basic Books, and it will be out, I hope, maybe like about a year from now. And it will, you know, in bookstores and so forth. So I hope it will get more attention. You know, it will maybe get a little bit more press than my original self-published book got. So that will help bring attention to this issue.
Does it sharpen any of the ideas that you discuss in Lights in the Dark?
Yeah, I mean, it you know, it has the same general theme, but there's a lot more detail, and it talks a lot more about some of the innovations that, of course, we've seen in the last 4 years, and more information about how all this is likely to develop going forward. So I hope it will help to, you know, bring more attention and debate to this issue.
Would you say that you've become significantly more optimistic or pessimistic since writing Lights in the Tunnel?
I would say fairly neutral. I mean, you know,
nothing's really changed.
You know, in the long term, I'm optimistic that we can solve this problem and we can leverage technology, you know, to work for all of us. But it will take a political effort to do that. I mean, it's not going to happen by itself. So I'm kind of a long-term optimist and a short-term pessimist.
Right.
Because I don't underestimate the difficulty of taking all this on politically. I mean, it's going to be an enormous challenge. I hope that eventually we will overcome that challenge and do what we need to do. And if we do that, then I think there's every reason to be optimistic in the long run.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks a lot. This was a real pleasure. I totally loved your book, and I was happy to talk to you.
Okay. Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Yeah. All right. Have a good day.